Welcome back and Happy New Year to all of you. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it really is a pleasure to welcome you to the first headliners of this new year. Many feel that tonight's topics is among the most critical issues facing us in the 21st century. And Deb, we've got a terrific crowd here. It tells us how important this issue is to a lot of people. I'm delighted to see you all here. Last year, discussions of global warming gained international prominence when the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to former Vice President Al Gore and the United Nations Panel on Climate Change. When the award was announced in October, NBC Nightly News turned to the University of Minnesota's Professor Deborah Swackhammer to comment on public environmental consciousness. As one of this country's leading freshwater ecologists, she has witnessed firsthand the effects of climate change and toxic contamination on our precious resource and has been working to raise public awareness of their consequences before it's too late. Last fall, she was among the scientific researchers at a national conference on Lake Superior discussing the effects of global warming that it's likely to have on the Great Lakes and consequently on our public health. So what is the probable impact of global warming on Minnesota's aquatic ecosystems? And is there anything we can do to reverse the inevitability of climate change? Deborah Swackhammer is director of the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment. She earned a PhD in limnology and oceanography from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and joined the faculty of the University of Minnesota in 1987. For the past 20 years, she has studied the ecological condition of the Great Lakes and is considered one of our foremost environmental scientists. She serves on the United States Environmental Protection Agency's Science Advisory Board and is a member of the International Joint Commission of the United States and Canada. She's a professor of environmental chemistry in the School of Public Health and was selected as the 2006 winner of the Harvey G. Rogers Environmental Health Leadership Award for her, quote, years of dedication, distinguished service, and technical contribution promoting the public's health through the preservation of the environment. Will you please join me in welcoming Professor Deborah Swackhammer?
Thank you very much, Mary. It's a real pleasure to be here with you tonight, and I'm very glad that it didn't snow, not because I don't like the snow. I love the snow, but I'm glad that it then allowed you all to come, and it's very nice to see all of you here. The topic of climate change is a very broad one, and I'm going to spend the first half hour of this evening talking about a lot of things related to climate change, kind of leading you through what we know about climate change and its impacts with a heavy emphasis on what we know about Minnesota and what the impacts are going to be on Minnesota, and then end the discussion with sort of the context for how we need to think about climate change as citizens, as a state, as a country, and for the world. And then we can have a wonderful discussion, and you can ask me any questions you like, going off in any direction you like. And to start things off, I first want to set the stage by telling you about the Institute on the Environment for just a few minutes. It is a new venture at the university. It is part of President Brunick's strategic positioning process at the university, and as part of that process to create excellence at the university and promote excellence, this multidisciplinary institute was created just a year ago, and I have the pleasure of serving as the interim director, the first director of the institute. The purpose of the institute is to discover solutions to the Earth's most pressing environmental problems. It's a laudable goal, but it's one that definitely needs to be addressed. We feel that the University of Minnesota is at the perfect time and in the perfect place to create such an institute. There's a lot of rush by other universities and colleges to address environmental issues, but the University of Minnesota, we believe, is truly the perfect location. We are a perfect natural laboratory at the confluence of the Great Lakes and the Great Plains and the Great Northern Forests. We have a land-grant mission to the state of Minnesota, and we have the most comprehensive university in the country with every single discipline represented right here in the Twin Cities campus. So we have a remarkable opportunity, which we are taking advantage of by creating the Institute on the Environment. So just for a minute, imagine a world where biofuels are being grown that make sense for the environment. Imagine a world where sustainable living is a way of life. It's not something you talk about or read about or discuss over coffee. It's actually the way we live. Imagine that the Mississippi River has a complete stewardship plan for its environment and its economy from Bemidji all the way to New Orleans. And finally, imagine that we have climate change solutions that are truly transformative and can transcend this great threat that we're faced with of climate change. These are the issues that the Institute on the Environment is addressing, and I use these slides to set the stage essentially for what we feel is the most important issue. Mary said that once already, but I will underscore it. We feel it is the most important issue confronting society today, which is climate change. So here in Minnesota, we sit in the middle of one of the continents, of course, in the world, and this is a problem that is confronting the entire world as well as Minnesota. So although I can talk about it as a local problem, it is clearly a regional and national and global problem. And the solutions actually need to be addressed globally as well as locally. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, from now on called the IPCC, because I can't say that fast five times. This IPCC was, in fact, is the body that was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize along with Al Gore. So that was what Mary referred to in her opening remarks. So the IPCC, the award-winning IPCC, just issued their most recent report in 2007, and I quote, "Warming of the climate system is unequivocal, as is now evident from observations of increases in global average air and ocean temperature, widespread melting of snow and ice, and rising global average sea level." And you can see there in the graphs, there are data showing surface temperature increasing, sea level rising, and snow cover decreasing. These are the evidence that led the IPCC to make this very bold and certain conclusion. We, of course, you've probably seen this picture before. These are recent data on sea ice coverage in the Arctic. And you can see that the yellow, the larger yellow outline is the 1979 to 2000 minimum ice cover and so forth. Those 30 years, 20 years, ice cover was quite complete. In 2005, that had shrunk to the green line. And by 2007, you can see that very drastic shrinking to the white area now covered. So the sea ice is not only shrinking, it's shrinking faster than our scientists have been predicting. The IPCC report, and I want to underscore the importance of this report, and I'm going to use a fair amount of data to talk to you about climate change. This IPCC report is probably one of the most robust and most reviewed documents out there, and this panel is one of the most well-respected panels out there. It consists of, there's one report, and it comes in four volumes. It took six years to write it. There are representatives from 130 countries on the panel, including 450 writers, scientists that wrote the report. They're scientific writers, 800 contributing authors, and more than 2,500 scientific experts were involved. So this is not just a few people putting their opinion down. This is just about the entire world's scientific community coming to consensus. This is a consensus report. So there is, to sign this report, you must agree with all the conclusions in it. So it's a remarkably robust and well-respected report. The temperature data that shows that we are currently undergoing warming is irrefutable. For the last 150 years, you can see that the temperature has been increasing and quite dramatically over the last 20 years. And if you look at the longer time frame over the last 1,000 years, you can see that, in fact, it's an even more dramatic change. If you look, here's the average over the last 1,000 years, and you can see over the last century this enormous increase up into temperature ranges that are much, much greater than anything that had been seen previously in the last 1,000 years. And we have data that go back 150,000 years that also show these kinds of similar patterns where this current warming over the last century is irrefutable. So the planet is warming. That's a fact. sorry, I went the wrong way. We also know that in addition to the warming being caused by increases in carbon dioxide, we also have increases of methane and nitrous oxide, which are additional heat-trapping or greenhouse gases. So in addition to CO2 and temperature increases, we are seeing that the gases that cause this warming have been increasing in a way that's totally consistent with the warming that we've seen. And let me quote again from the IPCC report. It is very likely, with a 90% confidence, that heat-trapping emissions from human activity have caused most of the observed increase in globally average temperatures since the mid-20th century. They are 90% sure that this warming is due to human activity. The projections for increases at the end of the century, meaning by 2100, are an increase of anywhere between 2 degrees Fahrenheit and 11.5 degrees Fahrenheit. These are very big increases. If you think about the graph that I just showed before, the increase is shown, trying to get my arrow going here, the increase is shown over here. You can see that this is just a half a degree. So 2 degrees to 11 degrees, actually that's a Celsius plot, but 1 degree to 5 degrees on that plot is a huge difference. So we're talking about a very drastic change in our climate. This graph simply shows the global picture in a more pictorial way, but suffice it to say that the more red there is, the more warmth there is, and you can see that there's a lot of red on this graph. And so we have lots of projections and models that converge in their predictions that we will see increased warming over the next many hundreds of years, depending on what we do. So what about Minnesota? The temperature in Minnesota, based on historical data, and these data many of the data that I'm going to show have been graciously supplied to me by Mark Seeley, professor here at the University of Minnesota and also the state climatologist, as well as Dr. Lucinda Johnson, who is a professor up at the University of Minnesota Duluth. These are some of Mark's data, and this graph clearly shows that over the last many years, Minnesota has also been experiencing a warming. Not a surprise. I think all of us probably have anecdotal evidence from our various experiences here in the state that, in fact, it is warming. We also have very clear evidence that supports, again, anecdotal evidence, that the average ice out date has been changing. And, in fact, we see that the ice out date has been creeping up quite regularly in Minnesota and elsewhere around the upper Midwest. Professor John Magnuson at the University of Wisconsin has actually spent the last 10 years looking at ice out data. It's amazing how many neighborhood groups keep track of these things. And we have statistical evidence that the ice out date has been increasing or coming sooner in the spring quite regularly. We also see changes in precipitation. Again, these are data from Minnesota as well as globally. Globally, you can see that we have a distinct increase in very wet days. It's an interesting scientific term, very wet days. But we have an increase over the last 10 to 20 years. And the bottom graph, the pluses mean that there's been an increase in these very wet days, and the negatives mean, the minus signs that are in red, indicate that there's been a loss of heavy precipitation. And you can see that one little dot right here, that would be Minnesota. So you can see that we have had an increase in very wet days as well. Looking also locally at Lake Superior, Lake Superior has been an interesting lake to study. It is so big. It is so massive. One often thinks that nothing can really harm it, nothing can really impact it. It is such a big lake. It holds 10% of the world's surface fresh water all by itself. The rest of the Great Lakes hold another 10%, but Lake Superior all on its own holds 10% of the world's fresh water, surface water. Recent work by Jay Austin and Steve Coleman up at UMD have shown that there's been a systematic increase in the temperature of the lake in response to the air. Now, it takes a lot of energy to warm up that lake. So this is a pretty big impact to actually see that the temperature of Lake Superior has been steadily rising. In addition, the percent of ice cover has been dropping, and that's the bottom graph. And why would we care so much about the ice cover? In fact, you might not even know that historically Lake Superior did have significant ice cover, and you can see that it's been dropping it certainly has its year-to-year variability, but with time there is statistical evidence to show that that's declining. And one of the big problems with seeing the loss of ice cover is that we're also seeing decreases in lake level of the Great Lakes. And it's because of the loss of ice you get increased evaporation of the water during the winter. As air passes over the lake, when there's ice cover, it's protected from evaporation like a blanket. And if you take off the ice, then you can evaporate the water. And we're seeing decreased levels of water in all of the Great Lakes as a result of decreased levels of ice cover. We also have a trend in dew points, and these are known as tropical dew points. When the dew point is greater than 70 degrees Fahrenheit, picture last summer when they would say, the dew point is 69, and it's 7 in the morning, and you're sweating. You know, dew point at 70 is a very uncomfortable dew point. So these are tropical dew points. And we don't think of Minnesota as being in the tropics, but we actually do have lots of dew points of 70 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. And again, these are data supplied by Mark Seeley. And you can see that there has been a steady increase in the dew point day. Again, variation over time. There's all sorts of natural variability. Some days it's cold, some days it's warm. But you can see that over time, there has been a statistical increase in the number of tropical dew point days in Minnesota. So let me just summarize what we know about what we see in the upper Midwest without attributing blame or getting into the future. Just what is it we know about Minnesota? We know we have warmer winters. I haven't shown you all these data. These are kind of a summary. We know we are having warmer winters based on the temperature record. We know that the minimum temperature is also higher over time. We're seeing spring earlier. We're seeing ice out earlier. We're seeing more really hot, muggy days, and we're seeing greater annual precipitation. So, again, I'm summarizing lots of data that I haven't shown you, but I've given you some example data. We see more days with rain. We see more frequent heavy rain, and we see trends in increasing winter snowfall, believe it or not. I know many of us, again, anecdotally say, oh, we haven't had much snow recently. But, again, if you look at the state as a whole and if you look at the actual record statistically, we are seeing that. So this is a summary of what we observe here in the state of Minnesota, and it's very typical of the upper Midwest and this sort of latitude of North America, if you will. So what's to happen in the future? The best way to summarize this is based on a report done by the Ecological Society of America and the Union of Concerned Scientists. This was done several years ago, but they specifically looked at climate change predictions for the upper Midwest. And the summary, this is a very clever graphic that they put together, and this shows that basically by the year, by the end of the 21st century, Minnesota will essentially have the climate of Kansas. So when it says where could Minnesota move to, we will look like Kansas. So the climate will move upwards. We're stationary, obviously, but the movement of the climate and the warming moving northward would give us a climate like Kansas. Now, I have nothing against Kansas. I like Kansas. But frankly, you know, I choose to live in Minnesota. I like Minnesota more. So I'm not too thrilled about this particular prediction, but it's important. This is a really easy graphic to just get a feel for. If you've ever been to Kansas in the summer, they have brutally hot winter summers, and in the winters, they have brutally cold and kind of difficult winters, and they have a lot of storms. And so I'm not sure Kansas is the place we want, but we're going to get it, Dorothy. The predictions that have been made for how the temperature will change in Minnesota are shown here. And in both of the graphs on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see a red line and a blue line. And those are the predictions. The green line are the actual data up to current times. And the blue and the red line represent different predictions based on different scenarios. So, for instance, we might imagine that as in the future, by the year 2050, we can predict a certain population and we can predict a certain energy consumption and certain uses of certain technologies. And those two lines are simply different models imagining different populations, population growth, different technologies being employed, different rates of adopting technology. So those are sort of two spreads of what our predictions might be for what the climate will look like in the future, what the temperature will look like in Minnesota in the future. And the point here, of course, is that it's going to get warmer. And how warm it gets, it depends very much on what kind of emissions we put into the atmosphere, and what kind of emissions we put in the atmosphere depends on the choices we make today about energy use, transportation use, and a number of other societal choices, which I'll get to in just a minute. Water levels. I had discussed already the role that ice cover plays with water levels in the Great Lakes, but this is true across the entire state for our smaller water bodies as well. So we have that one big lake, and then we have the 14,000 other lakes. And their short duration of ice cover will also have implications for the whole water cycle within the state of Minnesota and actually within the entire continent of North America. As we warm, the air temperature will increase evaporation. And if we have decreased precipitation in summer, we'll have a decrease in soil moisture and we'll draw down water tables. Now, whether that will happen or not is hard to say. Our ability to predict what precipitation is going to do 50 years from now, as you know, we can barely predict the weather 24 hours from now, but to predict precipitation 50 years from now is a very tough thing. And the models have differing predictions. In general, we believe Minnesota will be wetter than it is now, but there's a lot of uncertainty around those predictions. Intense storm events are predicted to increase under whether it's lower emissions or higher emissions scenarios into the future. You can see that those blue lines that show the future predictions of increased intense storm events all have a positive trajectory. So we expect to see an increase in these kinds of storm events in the Great Lakes region. Now, that's what we expect to see in Minnesota in terms of the trends, but what are the impacts of those things? Many people sort of think about climate change as, oh, it's going to get warmer. But if you stop and really evaluate for yourself what does getting warmer mean, it means a lot of different things. It's going to impact not just our ecosystem. It will impact our public health. It will impact our economy. It will impact global biodiversity. It will impact increased forest fires. It will impact our ability to use Minnesota to recreate. It will impact a lot of things. So our very well-being, in my opinion, our very society, is going to be highly impacted at levels that are almost hard to get our arms around. It's easy to think about getting warmer. It's a lot harder to think about the impact on geopolitical landscapes or economic landscapes. And we do know that as the climate changes and as all of these various things that I've been talking about change, we are going to see impacts at all sorts of dimensions and all aspects of society, way beyond just the physical aspects, way beyond the environmental thing. This isn't about environmental action or greening or environmental activism. Tree huggers. It's not about that. This is about everybody. This is about every aspect of our society. We are also going to see, this is an example of how you can imagine it might impact recreation and therefore the economy of the state. You know, recreation is, you know, it bounces around each year, but it's usually second or third in the list of the things that are most important to the economy of the state. We bring in a lot of money based on the fact that people like to fish and boat, et cetera. Well, if we have less ice cover, we have less ice fishing season, we have less income from that, we have less income from skiing, we have less income from snowmobiling, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we have anecdotal data from previous winters about how that has gone up and down, but clearly that has an impact. Those of you that have followed the state budget know that it does have a huge impact on revenue for the state. It also impacts, there are indirect impacts. So imagine as you get earlier spring snow melt, you get that runoff going into our streams and into our lakes, and that changes the temperature of the receiving water at a different point in time, and it stimulates the growth of algae and other food for the fish in those streams at a different point in time, maybe not at the time when the fish thought it was going to be, so they don't have food when they need it. They have food at the wrong time of their life cycle. So you can have these really indirect, very subtle impacts on things like the fishery that are due to these sort of, you know, connecting the dots of the ecology, but they're not really obvious at the start. So there's a lot of different ways that we can imagine that the warming of the climate is going to cause disruption, if not some, you know, cause real disruption for the state and for the nation and for the world. Another example is flooding. We expect to see increased flooding, but as a result of increased flooding, we'll also get increased soil erosion, degraded water quality, and again, economic impacts. Again, we all know that much of the state of Minnesota has had federal assistance and has needed federal assistance because of the economic loss and damage and destruction caused by flooding in the last 10 years in this state. A good example is the Red River. It's had droughts, it's had floods, it's really had a whole bunch of things happen to it. And higher temperatures are going to cause increased flooding at times, might cause increased droughts at times, and it will increase the intensity of storm events. I've mentioned the fish community in terms of their food supply, but it's also fish are very susceptible to water. Minnesota is really quite well known for its cold water fishery. We have wonderful trout streams and streams that run into Lake Superior, in particular up in the Arrowhead, that are well known for their fish community. But they need cold water. They can't do well in warm water. And you raise the water temperature just even a few degrees, again, at the wrong time of the year in particular, and you're going to lose that incredibly precious and very highly valued cold water fishery. So, again, we are concerned about the impacts on ecology, which then impacts the economy for the state of Minnesota. The changing climate will impact forests. We will see this gradual migration of various forests. The maple and oak, the deciduous forest that we know down here in this part of the state, will gradually move north and take over the conifer forests that we know up north. So up north, where we think of those beautiful conifers, they're going to migrate north, and pretty soon, in 50 to 100 years, what we'll see in the forests up in northern Minnesota will be the same kind of forest that we see here in southern Minnesota, central Minnesota, at this time. So the boreal forest, those wonderful conifer trees, will largely disappear from the state of Minnesota. That's a pretty big loss, both aesthetically, spiritually, and economically. And the other impacts, of course, besides impacts on the ecology or on the wildlife that live off that ecology, and, of course, the impacts for humans. Often in these discussions, we don't talk much about the potential impacts on humans, but I know there's a fellow in the audience who talked to me earlier before we started the event, and there's a lot of concern in the public health field about impacts on human health. There's some very direct things like as the climate warms, we will have excessive heat more frequently, and so we will have more stress on people that are susceptible to heat. That would include populations such as the elderly, populations that have asthma, or the very young. And so we're talking about health impacts from that kind of thing. Heat waves cause human deaths. We know that, and we will have heat waves as a regular event, not an unusual event, in the future. As the lower atmosphere warms, we will get more ozone. And the ozone is what causes those air alerts that you hear on the radio. The air quality index that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency puts out, that AQI is based on ozone. And the more heat we have in the lower atmosphere, the more we'll have air quality alerts and higher levels of ozone, which cause respiratory stress, again, in humans and in wildlife. We likely will have more vector-borne disease outbreaks, and by that it would be things like Lyme disease or West Nile virus. These are things that are carried or caused by mosquitoes, and as mosquito populations change and migrate and move, we will see increases in these kinds of public health threats. I just read an interesting article the other day that for the first time there's been an outbreak of a mosquito-borne disease in southern Europe, and it took them 4 months for the public health agencies to diagnose what it was. And it was an epidemic of a disease no one in southern Europe had ever seen, and it came from North Africa. Those mosquitoes that never bred before in southern Europe for the first time bred in a large way in southern Europe, and there was an epidemic of this very dreadful disease that looked a lot like dengue fever. Increased parasites, increased pests. We will see invasive, not just invasive species the way we think of animals or plants invading, but we will see invasive diseases as a result of vectors and changes in climate. Am I cheering you up yet? We also have economic consequences, and I want to keep stressing this, that it's not just about, oh, we might lose some trees or water level go down. This really is going to impact us where it really hurts as an economic power, but it will impact even the poor more. So the impact on the world is not equitable. It will impact poor nations far more than it will impact those nations such as ours that can adapt and adjust more readily. But this gives you an example of the kinds of things I mean. Why does it cost economically? Well, if we have more extreme storms, we know that those storms cost lots of money to take care of. And these are actual data showing weather disasters and the damage amounts in billions, that's billion with a B, billions of dollars. These are national data. And you can see that there is a gradual increase in the number of these kinds of events and the costs associated with these events over the last 20 years, 30 years almost now. So now that I've depressed you suitably, let's talk about what is it we can do, because I know that's one of the questions you're going to want to ask me. You're going to say, well, what is it we can do to stop this? Well, the most obvious is I could spend quite a bit of time telling you where the greenhouse gases are coming from and so how we might mitigate them. But I think most of you probably know that. They're mostly coming from our use of energy, the burning of fossil fuels, the generation of electricity by using fossil fuels such as coal and natural gas, and then the use of gasoline in our cars, trucks, planes, etc. And then the use of fertilizers, for instance, in agriculture. Agriculture is about 20% of the greenhouse problem because of the application of fertilizers produces nitrous oxide, which gets into the atmosphere, and that's a greenhouse gas. So there's lots of different greenhouse gases, and there's lots of ways they're getting into the atmosphere. Be that as it may, we have focused most of our discussion on how we can mitigate and stop climate change by focusing on energy and reduction of fossil fuels. Stop putting carbon into the atmosphere. Now, these tips, I don't expect you to be able to read those, I'm sure, but these tips are the kinds of things that you find on, for instance, how many of you have watched An Inconvenient Truth? Excellent. Well, if you've actually had the CD in your hands and you open it up, inside the front cover of the CD are tips, these exact tips. And I believe at the very end of his of Al Gore's CD, he's actually got this as part of the movie. So you can, there's a number of places, a number of websites you can go to. There are resources for you as an individual of what you can do. So as an individual, you can take responsibility, and that's first and foremost, is for you as an individual to take responsibility and not think, well, the government should do something. Well, guess what? We are the government. We should do something, and even an individual can make a difference, although it's not the answer to everything. I think initially the responsibility does lie with the individual. So, again, it's everything from changing fluorescent lights to changing incandescent lights to fluorescent lights, having your tires inflated properly. There's all sorts of things in this tip list, and I direct you to this particular website if you're interested for a very good discussion of these kinds of tips. However, it really is going to require a change in our thought process, not just the activities. We can't just change light bulbs and say, there, I've modified my behavior, and now I've fixed the problem. That's not going to change the problem. It's not going to fix the problem. All the light bulbs changed in the entire world would actually displace about 250 power plants, but that's not going to fix the problem. It really requires thinking about the problem from an ethical perspective, from a societal, from a civilization perspective. It is not just thinking about it from a science perspective. It's not just thinking about it as an environmental perspective. It requires thinking about this as a true change in how our societies function. And by embracing, what we need to do is embrace a conservation ethic and a conservation lifestyle initially. And many of you in the room, I think the reason you're here is because you have an interest in that and you have an ethic in that. Minnesota, I think, is a leader in demonstrating that kind of ethic. And so Minnesota can be a leader for the nation in changing our lifestyle, not just changing our light bulbs, changing our lifestyle. So some of the perspectives that I think it's important to discuss, and I'm hoping that our discussion today, this evening, can get at some of these other issues outside of the data showing whether climate change is happening or not. But getting past the science, I've showed you some of the science, and as a scientist, that's what I go to first. But we need to think about this not just as a science problem that can get fixed by science or a political problem that can get fixed by politicians. This problem requires really delving into our emotional selves. It is an ethical problem. I mentioned to you before that there are the poor nations are going to suffer more than the well-off nations. So the effects of climate change are not going to be spread equally. And it is a political problem, but guess what? Again, politics aren't in Washington. Politics are right here. So it is up to us to think about this problem and address this problem as a society, not just individually, and to address it in a holistic manner, not just from a scientific perspective. Let me finish by saying there is a growing sense of urgency about this process, about this problem. I haven't gone into the data that show this, but suffice it to say that we can show that for the next 30 years, the greenhouse gas emission trajectory is going to give us a consistent increase in temperature. And if we change our behavior today, the impact won't be felt until after 2050. So we're not going to see a big impact by changing our society today. You kind of have to take it on faith that this is not an experiment you want to run and wait and see if we can afford not to change. We can't afford to wait. We must make these changes now for us to see an impact, for our children to see an impact. And so we don't see that urgency in our everyday lives. We see a little bit of warming. We see less ice cover. We can see that there's warming, but it's not as if there is a bullet headed for us that we see. In reality, there is a bullet headed for us, just that it's headed for the next generation. It's not headed for us. It's headed for our kids and our grandkids. And so there is a sense of urgency. Let me simply then say that we need to think about this just from all these different E's. Actually, there's one H in there. So there's security issues, there are economic issues, there are environmental issues, there are energy issues. All of these things come into play. And we want to address it now in order to save this planet. Thank you.
Wow, Deborah, thank you very much. I bet there's a whole bunch of questions out here. So let us start close up here where I can reach you quickly.
I believe that humans are causing the climate to warm, but what do you make of, I didn't read the report, but the minority party in the Senate put something on the government website that said something like 400 scientists are saying that global warming is not caused by humans. Have you seen any of that study?
I haven't seen that specific study, but I have seen a number of references to various lists of people that disagree that climate change is occurring. And you know, I almost don't want to get into that debate because the overwhelming consensus globally by esteemed scientists from 130 countries around the globe agree that the data are irrefutable. So I don't think that there is much legitimacy to these studies that are being referred to by people that have a different agenda to basically not focus on the climate change issue. I believe that's a politically motivated thing.
Question over here. Yes. Is any real progress being made to show the financial advantage to first world countries to follow this outline? I mean, we frequently hear that, no matter what we do in this country or Western Europe, you have India and China, which is a third of the world's population. If they're going to go off and continue to do their thing, then what's the incentive for the Western countries to really try to tackle this problem? And I mean financially.
Yes, and finances really drive a lot of the decision-making in this world. I certainly won't deny that. It's clearly an economic driver, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to point out the impact on economics. It's a cost-benefit question. It's not just a benefit. So if you think about the things that I've talked about, their impacts, and you look at the economic loss, the cost, by doing nothing, it's huge. And so it's a question of getting everybody on the same page, understanding that overall, it is an economic benefit to address it now. We will save in the long run. You won't see the savings now. You won't see the savings in 10 years. You'll see the savings over a long time. So that's, again, it's a hard argument to make politically since our officials don't last that long. But that's the argument to make, is that you have to transcend the politics and get to the actual cost benefit, which the economists will show are it's a benefit to address it now. The politics seems to get in the way when it gets down to getting countries to pay attention, and there have been studies to show that addressing it now will definitely be more cost beneficial. But the problem is, if you take China or India, they're interested in investing and getting a fast return or a short-term return on infrastructure investments, on modernization investments, as an economic driver. And they're simply not putting the climate change piece into that cost-benefit analysis, because it's hard to quantitate, but it's an important part of the equation. And it's got a different time frame than investing in something that's going to give you a 10-year return as an economic driver versus something that's going to be a 100-year economic return. So part of it is that disconnect on time. I wish there was a more effective way to transmit that to the people that are negotiating these things.
I wonder, with the acceleration of the temperature predicted in the next 100 years, you talked about a century from now, is there any thought given to population migration from the southern part of the United States to the northern tier states? I mean, that would be a big, dramatic happening.
That's a very interesting question. I have not seen any studies that have predicted that, but that's a very interesting point.
Be a new meaning for snowbirds, right? Coming up here to find it. Do we have a question in the back?
I don't mean to sound terribly pessimistic, but I am. And my question is there any historical precedent for people making a large societal change when they don't, in fact, feel a crisis, when they don't see the bullet coming at them? And is there any historical precedent for one generation deciding to be generous to its own children? I don't think there is, but I'm hoping you have other ideas.
Well, I can answer that there is for the first scenario that you gave. The one other example is the concern over the global ozone layer, the stratospheric ozone layer. As we discovered that human activity was causing the destruction of the ozone layer, the United Nations Intergovernment Panel, the same group within the United Nations, again, brought together both politicians and scientists to, hash out what we knew to be fact and look at the predictions. And the dire consequences that were predicted were enough to have the United Nations act as a whole. And so enough nations joined onto that treaty, and banned the chemicals that were responsible for the destruction of the ozone layer. That process has now been reversed. The ozone layer the destruction has leveled off, and it's gradually healing itself. It will not be healed fully under today's scenario for about 150 years. So indirectly, we made a choice that we're going to give a better atmosphere, at least in terms of a better ozone layer, to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren with those decisions. And we don't really see that impact really clearly. In our day-to-day lives, we don't see whether there's an ozone hole or not. So I think that's a good example. The reason that was successful is that we had to ban one class of chemicals, and industry immediately stepped forward and found substitutes. So it was a very easy thing to regulate, and everyone around the globe agreed we could regulate those chemicals. The problem with climate change is that carbon dioxide, the primary heat-trapping gas, is emitted from so many quarters, and it's so tied into our lifestyle and our society, we can't just ban CO2. So it's a much harder fix, and it's a much tougher one for people to tackle. It involves tackling so many aspects of our society and technologies. The second one, I can't really offhand think of another example where we have made choices purely, sort of altruistically, for future generations that really cost us, that it was a tough choice. We make choices that aren't difficult, but the difficult choices are another thing entirely. I can't think of one offhand, but the ozone example is a great example and is the model that the Kyoto Protocol was trying to follow. They were trying to follow that same model. It hasn't gone as well as we had hoped.
We have a question over here on the right side, and then we'll come back here.
Yes. Could you comment, please, on greenwashing as it's done, is being done, unfortunately, in Minnesota and other places by industry, such as, for example, calling the burning of municipal waste a use of renewable energy as something healthy to be done, or, for that matter, burning so-called clean biomass, that this is somehow to generate energy from a renewable source, that would somehow be a clean and environmentally progressive way to generate energy.
I'm going to break your question into two answers. answer your question two different ways, I guess. The first is the greenwashing by companies. Certainly there is some of that out there, but I also want to say that corporate America and corporate Europe and corporate Western world does see the economic piece. They are doing their cost-benefit analyses, and they are seeing that in many cases it is more economical for them. They're not being necessarily ethical about their choices, but they do make decisions based on the bottom line, on money. And many corporations have done analyses to show that if they change their behavior, if they mitigate climate change, or change technologies to reduce emissions, they are saving money. And so they're legitimate. They are actually changing their processes. They're not just saying they are actually changing their processes. Not all of corporate America is doing that, but a good many of the Fortune 500, for instance, are signing on to climate change commitments and are actually changing. They're not just, you know, it's not just symbolic. They're actually changing processes. That said, when you get down to actual examples that you gave, the definition of renewable energy is one of those very debated definitions. It's like sustainability. What is sustainability? There's, you know, 25 definitions in the literature and the press, and renewable energy can sometimes suffer from that same problem of not knowing exactly what's renewable. Certainly, if you take the strict definition of renewable, biomass is renewable. You can grow it and regrow it and regrow it, and it's renewable. Whether it's actually offsetting carbon, you can get into a whole other level of conversation about whether it's helping with the greenhouse problem. But so you can get into some semantics, but there are some legitimate and, I believe, helpful efforts being paid by the business world, by the corporate world. The private sector is perhaps stepping up more than our politicians. In fact, I would say they are stepping up more than our politicians to make us focus on climate change.
There are now about 7 billion of us, and it's a young population. And if we just reproduce ourselves, we'll level off at about 11 billion. And all of us burn something or other, eat something or other, cut down forests to make room for our children, et cetera. And one thing that's missing from this discussion, and which none of the politicians seem to have the courage to address, is population control. And if we don't stop producing more people, we're not going to stop producing more CO2 and other waste.
I think there's no excuse me for a little horse tonight. I think there's no doubt that population has a huge impact on this whole equation. And yes, world population is slated to increase, and most of the projections seem to think we'll level off at a mere 9 billion. But that's still an awful lot of people. I had an interesting discussion yesterday with one of my colleagues, Don Philippon, in the rhetoric department here at the university. And Dan showed me a book that likened, a scientist had done this analysis of the metabolism of organisms and their how big their population was, okay? And it correlates very nicely until you get to humans, and we're completely not on this graph. So you go from bacteria up to elephants, and you can make a very nice line, a straight line of that. And you get to humans, and basically we consume, so it's sort of consumption versus metabolism. And we, based on what we consume, we should be the size of, we're essentially, one human is equivalent to a blue whale. And I guess the scientist then wrote a book on this concept that, you know, basically we're a planet of 6 billion blue whales. And if you think about the population that way, clearly there's not enough room for 6 billion whales on this planet. So it's a very effective kind of thing if you can't sort of conceptualize population in a numbers way, just think about a whole lot of blue whales. So basically, I'm sort of not making light, really, but pointing out that we consume far more than we should be for our size and who we are in the general scheme of the animal kingdom. And we not only have too many of us, we consume much more than we should as individuals. And that's part of what I'm saying, that we need not just societal, we're not just technological fixes or emission reductions. We need societal changes in terms of consumption. We need societal changes in terms of understanding our population growth.
I've got a question. Is there a problem with these new light bulbs? They have mercury in them. And are we exchanging one problem for another? Are we going to be disposing these? And I can't see all of us disposing of these properly. It's going to get into our ground system, and we're going to have a water problem with that, aren't we, sometime soon?
It's my understanding, that's an excellent question. It's my understanding that the current generation of fluorescent light bulbs do not have mercury. I'm looking at the utilities person for the university, and he just nodded, so I'm correct there. No. So if you buy today's fluorescent bulbs, you know, not the old ones from 10 years ago, but today's, they are mercury-free. They're also far more efficient than they used to be. So, yes, buy them. Your incandescent light bulbs will be no longer sold in a few years. So,
back here, please.
Hi. I understand that our choices of transportation are really important, but I've also read that... I'm over here. I've also read that our choices of food are very important as well, if not as important as our choices of transportation. In particular, I understand that the resource-intensive meat-based diet has a significant impact on global warming. And I'm just curious, if you agree with that, but then also, why is it that on all of these suggestion sheets that we see and the tips that we see for what we can do, why don't you ever see the suggestion to adopt a vegetarian diet?
Excellent question. You'll see in this tip sheet, actually, if this is still here, there is, yes, the very last one is act globally, eat locally. So they address that. You don't see that a lot, and it's an interesting question that you raise. I've actually been kind of curious about that very thing myself. A lot of studies have shown that the resources necessary to produce the grain to feed our livestock to support our meat-heavy diet certainly stress the environment tremendously. And to change practice, so again, when I'm talking about societal change, to really change the way we think about treating the environment and treating our atmosphere, I do think that's going to have to enter into the discussion, that we need to find ways to provide protein in our diet that is not as harmful to the environment. If you think about the gentleman that talked about population, we have 6 billion people on the planet, and as you pointed out, there's a third of them are in India and China, and they still do not yet have a meat-rich, their protein is not coming mostly from meat, and so they're... If they were to want our lifestyle and to have the livestock to have the meat to support the same diet we have, well, basically we don't have the land to produce the grain, to produce the livestock, to support another 3 billion people eating the diet that we so luxuriously enjoy. So eventually there is going to be a discussion about this, but it seems to be that we're being dragged kicking and screaming about that discussion. Although I will say there's been some recent attention paid to it, and sounds like you're probably someone who's already aware of the Michael Pollan work, and a number of other authors have written books on the cost to the environment, if you will, and the cost to society with meat-based diets. So I think it's going to be part of the discussion.
Another question over here. Go ahead.
Yes, from time to time, stories pop up in the popular press about proposals to channel Great Lakes water to the southwest and other such fantasies. And I know Minnesota is trying to join a regional compact or something to resist those efforts. What's your assessment of all that?
Oh, boy, I could talk for hours on this one. I have very strong feelings about this. Yes, that's not fantasy. That's actually been raised quite seriously, and most recently it was raised by Bill Richardson, the now former, I believe, Democratic candidate for the presidency. So the governor of New Mexico raised this issue. Many people have raised this issue. We have, you know, 18% of the world's fresh water sitting right here in North America. Arizona has golf courses. Why not just take all that water down to Arizona? I'm being facetious because I feel very strongly about this, so I'm going to just put my bias right out there. The Great Lakes governors feel very strongly that actually that's a resource that isn't just water for that should be consumed. It needs to be preserved. It's an enormous resource. There's nothing else like it on the planet. And it needs to be preserved and used appropriately. And so there's quite a fight about that. So the Great Lakes governors formed what was called a compact, and they actually have a document called the Annex 2001, which then led to a Great Lakes governors compact. That is a written agreement that says we will not allow the extraction of Great Lakes water outside of the Great Lakes Basin. So they've got a volume limit on it, but you can't take water out of the Great Lakes Basin, even across the basin line. So there are communities, for instance, in the state of Minnesota. Most of the state of Minnesota is not in the Great Lakes Basin. And so you couldn't bring drinking water from Lake Superior to, say, Bemidji if you wanted to, because it's against the charter of the Great Lakes Boundary Waters Treaty from 1909 to not move out water. And they've had a number of amendments since then in court cases. And again, I could go on and on about the history of this, but the Great Lakes really, governors are very firm about this. The issue is whether it has the force of law. So there's this treaty between U.S. and Canada that says you can't take the water out of the basin. There are court cases, but they're on the U.S. side. What if the federal government of the U.S. said, sure, let's take water out of the Great Lakes. We're going to override the governors because who are they? But then what about Canada? Would you end up with some sort of international court action? So it's a very complicated legal issue, and there are whole books written on this. Most recently, something called The Great Lakes Water Wars. I recommend it highly. I'm blanking on the author's name. He's actually a friend of mine, and the lights are making me forget his name. But I can get you the author's name. It'll come to me in about 5 minutes, I'm sure. Peter Annan, that's it. Don't tell him I said that. Annan is A-N-N-I-N, Peter Annan. And it's called Great Lakes Water Wars. It's a wonderful history of the whole issue and puts it in a present-day context.
Great save there, Deb. Question back here.
Hey there. Sort of bouncing back to the comment on greenwashing and maybe more a little close to home, ethanol and just sort of the how do we cut through the haze on whether or not that is a viable and a greener alternative? It stands to benefit Minnesota, and so we sort of have, you know, a little bit more at stake there with making the decision on whether or not it is a good option. But is it a better option? Is it a step along the way? Kind of a, maybe that's the question: is how do we, you know, what's a good resource to sort of identify a good way to feel about it? Because, you know, we want a benefit, but we also want the longer term benefit too.
Sure, it's a source of great discussion. Both here in Minnesota, especially here in Minnesota, as well as the rest of the nation. It depends on what you're asking, what it's good for. So ethanol is good economically for the state of Minnesota. And so the answer there is yes, it's good for the state of Minnesota economically. If you ask if it's good for the environment, growing more corn for ethanol is not necessarily good for the environment. In general, I would say it's not good for the environment. It's not good because of the stress it puts on our water resources, both in terms of pesticide and nutrient application and subsequent runoff. And it's not good for our environment because of also the pesticide emissions into the atmosphere and so public health issues and that kind of thing. Is it good for mitigating greenhouse gases because it's not a fossil fuel? Well, it takes a lot of fossil fuel to produce ethanol, and it comes down to being slightly better, about 1.2 is the number. So it's maybe 20% better than just gasoline in terms of being impacting the climate. So it's got a mixed report card. It's not that it's a perfect solution. Most people at this point in time, I say most because I think it is pretty controversial, agree that ethanol is the step in the right direction to get us away from pure oil, from from the oil addiction that people talk of. But it's not a long-term solution because it has all these other problems. And the other problem, of course, is that the economic benefit is based on our price structuring and the peculiarities of the farm bill. And so it's not really an economic benefit. It's a bit of a shell game. So in the long run, it's not considered to be a sustainable option, a good sustainable option.
We have a question in the back and then at the center table here.
excuse me. This question calls for your expertise on Lake Superior, but with a geographic shift. 12,000 miles away, when Three Gorges Dam matures as a reservoir, it will be the size of Lake Superior, according to the Chinese, which they're very proud of that fact. But it'll then be a 10% body of fresh water, highly polluted, but it'll also be a weather factor. Have you or has anyone else studied the impact of that much water in a subtropical area?
I have not personally, and I don't know anyone personally, but I have heard reference to it sort of indirectly that there is evidence certainly in the Great Lakes Basin that the Great Lakes, the vast area of them and the amount of water trading places between the atmosphere and the lakes themselves has a pretty big impact on microclimate around the area. Certainly we all know about snow, the lake effect snow. That's a classic example of how the lakes can impact climate. I have heard reference to this lake in China, but I don't know much more about it. I'll just leave it at that. It probably will have an impact just because of its size.
Could you please explain how global warming creates the violent weather that we've been seeing recently and into the future?
I'm no climatologist, but as I understand it from Mark Seeley, who very patiently has tried to explain this to me, is that as you get greater evapotranspiration, you get greater vertical changes in the air masses. As that water comes off, it changes the temperature of the atmosphere, and you get a lot of mix in the atmosphere, and you get a lot more transduction. Of bringing other air in. So you create a lot more violence, if you will, in the atmosphere because of the moisture. It's more about the moisture than the temperature, almost. So it's the violent weather is driven by water. It's not driven by temperature. The temperature is causing the water change in the atmosphere, changing that whole water cycle. So it's a function of the water cycle itself. Does that help? I'm a little thin ice on that one.
I wondered if you could address the whole bottled water phenomenon and, tap water that's more expensive than gasoline and huge waste stream, and also if there's an effect on all of that water being shipped out of one watershed into another.
They're both actually very real issues, and I'm smiling at the bottled water issue because it's a pet peeve I have, and I have spoken to the media about this before, but I know there are, my husband and I have a kind of a running joke about bottled water issues. But anyway, the bottled water issue, let's see if I can summarize it pretty clearly here. The bottled water is expensive, and here we are in the United States that has the safest drinking water in the world. We can point to disasters. We can point to the Milwaukee incident. We can point to the Walkerton, Ontario incident. But when it comes down to it, we have the safest water in the world. What goes into the bottled water is not as protected as our tap water. It's not tested the same. It's not under the same regulations. It's not subjected to the same scrutiny. And in fact, many times it is simply tap water bottled that you then pay a lot of money for. So in terms of just the water, the public health issue, you're better off drinking tap water, always. The second issue is the environmental consequences. Studies have shown that upwards of 80% of those wonderful plastic, Dasani, et cetera, bottles are not recycled. They're landfilled. And they are a significant part of the biomass of landfills because we drink so much bottled water. So if you're going to drink bottled water, that's okay. It's a personal choice. Please recycle your plastic bottle. And then the third thing has to do with making sure that you've got adequate protection from microbes. So there's chemical contamination we worry about in terms of drinking water, but we also want to be protective of microbes in pathogens in bottled water. And oftentimes people reuse those bottles, and there can be some contamination issues around that as well. So in general, bottled water is, you're much better off to buy a reusable bottle, one of the polycarbonate bottles or a aluminum bottle, and fill it with tap water. And if you don't like the taste and odor of your tap water, then get one of those lovely little Brita filters and filter it, and it'll come out smelling wonderful and tasting fine, and it's cleaner than anything you're going to buy in a bottle. That's my other stump speech about that.
Deborah, what do we need to do to keep the permafrost from melting? Because from what I've read, when that starts melting in Alaska, Canada, that's going to release all the CO2 that's been trapped, and then it's going to be really tough to control the CO2.
That's one of the things that we're already seeing happen, actually, is the permafrost is melting at a rate that's predicted, but that then causes an accelerated rate of CO2 input into the atmosphere. You're absolutely right. It also, there's some other feedback loops within the Arctic regions and Antarctic regions that exacerbate the climate problem as a result of the permafrost melting in the Arctic in particular. I don't know that there is anything we can do about the current melting. As I said, anything we do now, we won't see the impact of that affecting the CO2 concentrations for another 20, 30, 40 years. So the permafrost is going to continue to do what it's going to do for the next 30, 40 years, and there's nothing we can do about that in particular. That quieted you down.
Yes. Can crops be modified to capture some of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere?
Yes, there's been talk of that, and also the talk of just planting more biomass that is more carbon sequestering, carbon capturing than existing plants that are out there, or to take annual cropland and plant it in perennial crops of any kind to capture that carbon and sequester it. The problem is there isn't enough land to plant enough biomass to capture enough carbon. It's one of the strategies. It's not to say we shouldn't do it. I mean, when you get a Christmas card that says, oh, I planted a tree to help save the planet on your behalf, that's a good thing. It's good to plant trees, and it's good to sequester carbon in any way we can. But there's no one solution. Of all the solutions you hear in the news and the press that you read about, no one solution is going to solve this. It will require all of them in concert. So, yes, we should plant trees and biomass and even genetically engineered biomass, but no matter what, there's no one scenario that can show that strategy will be the thing we can do and we're done. But it's one of the tools in the toolbox, as they say.
My question is going back to the storm question and increase in frequency of those violent storms. One of the graphs that you had up there had showed, and I may have misunderstood it, but kind of showed the increase in frequency of violent storms based on high emissions and based on low emissions, and there looked like there was a pretty still substantial increase in those violent storms, even if we had lower emissions. Can you explain that?
Yes, I think I can. I believe it's because those violent storms are caused by the water vapor in the atmosphere, not so much the emissions themselves. So it's not the temperature of the atmosphere or the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. It's how much evapotranspiration you get. And the models for the Midwest on that particular issue kind of converge on saying that regardless of what temperature range you're going to get or what the emission scenarios are, the amount of evapotranspiration is pretty similar under either scenario, and that's what drives the storm cycles. It's the water cycle, it's not the temperature. And it's the temperature affecting the water cycle, affecting the storms.
I have another question about wind energy, and that is I'd like to know where we're at in the Midwest and what needs to be done to fully develop this potential in the Midwest.
There's a lot of work being done on wind, and Minnesota actually is right up there. We're not the leader in this, but we're certainly right up there. Thank you very much. And again, wind is a great option for helping offset energy use by fossil fuels. It's just not going to be the only answer. You know, we need to be looking at all of the options for renewable energy. So wind is a good option to look at. Solar is a good option to look at. All the, you know, other things that are being bandied about are good to look at, renewable biomass, that kind of thing. One unfortunate thing is that all of these come with a certain price, if you will. I don't mean an economic price necessarily, but a price. And so with wind, if you have large wind farms, one of the concerns is the impact on wildlife that nest in the area. The impact of the noise of those turbines can impact their habitat as well as kill animals that use that flyway. So either birds that are migrating or nesting in the area or bats that get out at night and they don't see the blades and they get killed. So there is research showing that wind farms can have some impact environmentally or ecologically. But on the balance, it's certainly a good thing to look at because it really does provide a lot of energy, particularly locally. So small communities, small, you know, farms. There are certain buildings in some university campuses that are run purely by wind, not on this campus, but in other places. Our university campus in Morris is 50% of the energy at Morris is generated by a single turbine on that campus. So it's really good for local generation. We're not good at, we haven't figured out how to transmit the energy produced by wind long distances. So it, unlike the electricity grid where we can burn energy in a power plant and then transmit it all over the place, we can't do that with wind cost effectively. We can do it, but it's not at all. It doesn't make sense. So until we have better ways of storing and transmitting that energy, that's one of the drawbacks. But it does mean that it's a good source for local energy production. But it's just one of many, many things we need to be considering. Again, if we don't have enough ability to generate, to serve our energy needs just from wind.
Yes, I have a question on the global warming impact on the great conveyor belt of the the ocean currents. From my understanding, it could be that it could be more catastrophic and more immediate than just the general impact of global warming on other issues. More just that bullet could be much sooner, so to speak. So I understand your background in oceanography, so maybe you can speak to that.
Yes, it's really freshwater oceanography, but yeah, I did study oceanography. The ocean current phenomena that this gentleman is talking about is that all our oceans are sort of connected by this ribbon of current that goes circumnavigates each of the oceans and throughout the planet. And if that conveyor belt will stop, it is actually what helps warm North America, like the Gulf Stream helps warm North America and Northern Europe. And if that was interrupted, we would see catastrophic changes in climate immediately. It wouldn't be over a period of time. It would be catastrophic. There have been movies about this, you know, a couple of popular movies. And it's a real phenomena. If that were to happen, we would see catastrophic climate change, unprecedented. The likelihood of that happening in the mainstream consensus of the scientific community is that it's highly unlikely that that is going to happen. An awful lot more would have to happen to get to that point. That would be a real tipping point of unprecedented tipping. But there's a lot of other things that would happen prior to that tipping point. It's not thought to be a very likely scenario. I mean, it's thought to be a remote chance. Mainstream. There we go.
Global warming sounds kind of dire, and climate change sounds almost a bit sanitized. I wonder when the switch came. It used to be that all we heard was global warming, and all of a sudden now it's changed, and it almost makes it sound like the problem isn't quite as significant as globally warming.
Excellent point. I actually have struggled with that myself. You know, when I talk about it, I find I use language differently. It really was very motivated by the politics of the time. So in the Clinton administration, they talked about climate change. They talked about global warming. And in the Bush administration, because his policies didn't recognize or support that as an issue, they needed a way to talk about it that didn't sound as problematic. And so they changed the language being used by the federal government and all their studies and all their documentation to climate change because it was a lot different. That language has kind of stuck with us, and I use it myself. It does get past the who's to blame thing. Climate change basically said is climate changing, and the answer to that is irrefutable. The answer is yes. Are we having climate change? Yes. global warming has these other kind of connotations, and people can get sidelined or distracted or hijacked by the conversation about what do you mean by that. But climate change is a little bit more specific, and not you can't really debate that. It is happening. So part of it is that, but I think it's also we just got used to using the language of the last 8 years. Good point.
Deb, I have a question about the tips that you included in your slide. My husband has this idea that he's been pitching to me that you get more carbon sequestration from younger trees, and that when trees reach some level of maturation, and I'm not clear what that is, they no longer are successful in sequestering carbon, and that there should therefore be kind of selective harvesting. I assume that it depends, if this is right at all, I assume that it depends on the, well, here's my husband. then I assume it depends on the species of the tree, and I wanted to find out if that's right, and if someone is developing kind of a chart that says, you know, when your bur oaks are 115 years old, cut them down, and, you know, or something like that. That would be practical application of that information.
Well, Ginny, I hate to tell you, but Don is right on the first part. So, yes, the age of the tree, they sequester carbon differently depending on age. So that is true, but it varies very much by species. And as you know, different species grow at different rates. And so one of the mitigation strategies that's been talked about is planting lots of fast-growing trees such as poplar, and they sequester lots of carbon. But the problem is they also live to a short lifetime relative to, say, an oak. So, you know, at 30 years old, they're mature, and they're kind of done with their sequestering. It's much diminished. Plus, if you're going to harvest the poplar for biomass, all you're doing is burning that carbon and putting it into the atmosphere as CO2. So unless you sequester it in a different way, you know, capture it, then you haven't really, you've just offset it by time, but not by actual carbon emitted. But yes, different species do things differently. And if you think about species of trees, you know, everything from really fast-growing poplars to, you know, redwoods, there's quite a difference in how they sequester carbon. There is a lot of work that has been done. I don't know of any one chart that shows the carbon sequestration of different species, but I'm pretty sure it exists. So I will look for that and get that for you.
Thank you. Say, my question seems to be somewhat pessimistic for sure, but it in listening to everybody here, it certainly sounds like there are all sorts of loaded guns that are about to go off. And from my perspective, I'd like to know which bullet is going to hit us first that will finally allow the political machine to really take this in earnest and really do something about it. So in other words, which disaster is going to happen first?
I don't know that I can predict which disaster, but I do think, I firmly believe that people and governments respond to these kinds of things only when there is a crisis, when there is something really visible. For climate change, until it affects your everyday life, you know, all of us are guilty of this. Until it affects our everyday life, we might talk about it, we might care about it, we might, you know, donate money towards the cause, but we don't change. We don't actually address it. I'm as guilty as anyone about that. And so until it affects us personally, we're not going to pay that much attention. We're starting to see these effects of climate change in Minnesota. And so now I think, you know, everyone in this room probably has an anecdote about, yeah, the weather, the this, the that. You know, you've got anecdotes. You're seeing it affect you. We're seeing it in the price of oil. We're seeing it in the whole discussion around ethanol and gas. We're seeing it in all sorts of daily conversation. Climate change is now front and center. It's right here. It's affecting our everyday life. Governments respond when it impacts money. So I think if there is enough discussion or enough disasters or hopefully it won't come to that, that people will simply see the projection of the fact that it's going to cost so much to mitigate later and it would be so much better to mitigate now. But I don't know. But I do think what's going to change, the only way people are going to change is because it affects their everyday life, it affects their sense of place and their sense of self, and when it affects the economy.
I just have one follow-up on that. Educationally, it appears to me, in my pessimistic look at this again, but that the people of today are not going to do something about it. It's going to end up, you know, with the younger generation really having the political force to do it. It's kind of like give peace a chance, and it's a different venue, and it's a different group of young people who are going to help promote it. So are we doing anything educationally in the school systems at all to promote it? You know, the change is what we need.
Yes, actually, I think that may be the one saving grace, and maybe the other positive thing to talk about is that we see tremendous interest in the students on the subject, and they take it terribly seriously, and they're a little bit angry at the older generation for not taking it as seriously, for not really getting upset about this. The younger generation, and by younger, I'm sort of talking generically about who we interact with here at the university, the college age kids are very, very, very concerned about this. I get phone calls all the time from student groups and from students who want to know what the university is doing and what are we doing as a campus for climate change. And actually, the University of Minnesota is doing a lot about their carbon footprint. The students want to know where to get courses, and so we're offering more and more courses on this because they're hungry to learn about the science, they're hungry to talk about the ethics, they're hungry to deal with it, to grapple with it. I think it's possible that instead of waiting for a crisis, that it may be, as we saw with the sort of revolution of the 60s in terms of the younger generation really changing society. I mean, there were major changes at that time. Maybe it's this generation of 20-somethings that are going to have a revolution, a societal revolution, to really change our behavior as a society. And I hope that's the case.
Let's take two more questions. We have a question back here, right, and then one back.
I've heard that if we were to cover an area the size of New Mexico with solar panels, that would provide all the energy that we need for electricity in this country. So maybe Bill Richardson could send us electricity instead of us sending him water. But really what my question is, solar energy is one of the things we've heard about for years, and the amount of solar energy in the world is enormous. Where do we stand in terms of our ability to harness that, and it's particularly in a northern state like us? And secondly, what's the downside? I mean, there's always a price to pay. What's the downside for solar energy?
Sure, and I'm no expert in this, so I'll talk generally about this. My understanding with the issue of solar energy is that it's not cost effective. The downside it causes some damage somewhere. There's no downside in terms of ecological damage, the way I mentioned in terms of the potential for wind power to have some negatives, but the issue is that it's not cost effective, and so it doesn't take hold without. The only place where you see real jumps in the technology for solar is where there's been investment, where there's been tax incentives, there's been offsets, there's been some kind of incentive within the economic structure of the country to do the research to develop better and more efficient solar panels that are cost effective for everyday use, and that it really hasn't crossed that threshold yet. There are certainly uses of solar power, and there are lots of demonstration sites. But for widespread use to get solar power to be a major part of the portfolio, there needs to be some work to make solar panels more efficient and to bring them to use in a more cost-effective way.
Could it work in a climate like ours?
Yes. I forget what rank we are nationwide in terms of overall solar days, put it into some equal kind of currency to do with sunlight. But we're up there. We get a ton. We get a lot of sunlight relative to a lot of other states. We get a lot more than the rest of the upper Midwest, for instance. We get a lot more sunlight than Wisconsin or Michigan or the eastern Great Lakes states. So we do have the potential to use solar effectively, but it's it needs to be made more cost-effective and more efficient.
And wait till Kansas moves up here. We'll have plenty of sun. You were very kind in your comments about Kansas. I grew up there and went to school.
Probably offended half of you. Sorry.
We have one last question over here.
Could you address nuclear energy and its future in this state, as well as hydrogen energy?
Two other energy options are to generate hydrogen using fuel cell technology and other technologies, but that's certainly on the drawing boards. we know how to generate hydrogen from water. That the science is known. It's again putting it into some kind of fuel cells for cars. We have to figure out how to make them safe. We have to figure out how to store that. We have to figure out how to transport the hydrogen safely. There's a lot of just technological infrastructure issues. So people think that we'll probably be largely hydrogen-based transportation, where our transportation needs will be dominated by hydrogen technology probably in, say, 20 to 40 years. So there's a lot of optimism around the hydrogen issue, particularly for transportation. The issue of nuclear is extremely controversial. I talk to my colleagues and friends and family about this quite a bit, and where we might agree on a lot of the things I've talked about tonight, you know, sort of lockstep about our feelings about this, this is not something where I think there's a consensus in the scientific community or in the general public. The general public, and I think, studies have looked at how the citizens view risk of nuclear energy, and it's usually out of proportion of the, you know, actual risk or the way scientists would view the risk of nuclear energy and the risk of power plants. So I think there's a disconnect between how scientists think about it versus the general public, but within the scientific community, even though they may assess the risk in a more accurate way, there's a lot of discussion about the issue, not so much the risk of the plants themselves, but the storage issue. Those are the two big problems. I think the risk issue of the plants can be addressed. It's an infrastructure issue, and we can ultimately do fine with that. We have done fine with that, and the rest of the world has done reasonably well with that. The storage issue is a whole other issue. My personal opinion is that it needs to be on the table with all these other options as we move forward. Nuclear is carbon neutral, and it does have these downsides, you know. So there's no silver bullet, as they say. We have a lot of different options to address to generate energy, and I believe that should be on the table for discussion and for development. But I will be the first to say that's not a consensus opinion, as I've presented much of the rest of tonight.
Could I respond to that? And I've been an environmental consultant for some time, and I've especially studied the nuclear issue. And there's an aspect that is widely misunderstood, and that is the view that nuclear is carbon neutral and is a widespread solution to the carbon dioxide problem. But unfortunately, this isn't true. If you drive down the Ohio River Valley, the Tennessee River Valley, you see one big coal-fired plant after another. And why have they put in these huge belching coal-fired plants? It's to supply the gaseous diffusion plants, which are the most energy-intensive industry in the United States. Some estimates are that some years, 25% of our electricity has been consumed by the three gaseous diffusion plants. And these coal-fired plants, they're not supplying energy for that little hillbilly up there with his still. But Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Paducah, Kentucky, and the third plant down in Portsmouth, Ohio, these are the most energy-intensive industries in the world. And they enrich the fuel for nuclear power plants and provide enrichment for weapons as well. But some years the estimate has been as much as 25% of America's electrical production consumed by the three fuel enrichment plants. I recently got a brochure from the Chamber of Commerce of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and they were bragging, this little town of Oak Ridge, we consume 15% of America's electrical production. And so with the other two gaseous diffusion plants, it's 20 or 25%. And our nuclear power plants produce about 20% of the electricity. So, but they're based upon a huge amount of burning of coal.
Thank you for that, for those comments. And what you've done is correct me for something that I should have caught for myself. And that is, when we talk about energy production, whether it's carbon neutral or not, it depends. You know, when I talked about the ethanol issue, if you just talk about burning ethanol, it's not that that creates lots of carbon dioxide. It's all those externalities of producing, of getting and growing the corn and harvesting the corn and turning it into ethanol. And what you've pointed out, sir, is that there are costs, carbon costs, in producing nuclear power that's not at the power plant. And that's exactly right. So that's a very good point. Thank you.
Well, this is obviously a really well-informed and also really interested audience, and I think all of us want to thank you for sharing your expertise tonight. This is tremendous.
Thank you. I just hope I passed my oral exam.
With flying colors, right? You know, I'm struck too by when you talked about the strategies for solving this. It's sort of like my favorite guess for a multiple choice exam. It's E, all of the above. We have to do right, all of the above. Deborah, thank you so much. It's really exciting and promising to know that people like Deborah are here at the university, teaching students, doing the research, and enlightening us as well. And we thank you for that. Next month, I hope you'll join us again. The first Thursday, that'd be February 7th. And we're going to have with us Professor Luis Mendoza, who is the chair of the Department of Chicano Studies. And Luis just completed an 8,500-mile biking trip across the United States studying Latino communities and looking at the impact of this largest minority now on our fabric and on our culture. And it should be a very exciting and interesting report from Luis about that journey and the implications he saw. So please join us again.